From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Tara Hills Benoll.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
The Yorktown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll hear about a program at City College of San Francisco that helps formerly incarcerated students.
There's a part of us that doesn't feel completely human or completely accepted in society.
Then we'll go searching for some familiar comfort food.
Our order is 6 pieces of falafel. I'll make 7. The 7th one is the taxes, you know. Uncle Ramsey has to have his taxes, so I get a falafel and I just eat it by itself. I love eating it by itself.
And we revisit the well-worn tale of San Francisco's iconic sourdough bread.
Now, there is nothing accurate about that story. That just blows my mind, that we have a whole story that we all tell each other, and there is no part of it that is true.
Something to chew on, coming up on Cross Currents. For the past year and a half, we've been covering the troubles facing City College of San Francisco. The college has until this coming July to meet a set of requirements, or its accreditation could be revoked. That could leave thousands of students in the lurch. City College is California's largest community college. It's one of the largest in the country, in fact, with enrollment between 70 and 80,000 students. Later this week, we're going to devote an entire show to that issue, but today we're bringing you the story of just one of City College's many students.
My name is Carl Irons. I'm a graduate of an alumni now. God, it feels strange to say that. An alumni of City College of San Francisco. I'm currently a student at San Francisco State University. My degree from City College was in paralegal studies.
Irons took part in City College's Second Chance program, which provides formerly incarcerated students with help ranging from money for books and bus passes to academic counseling and sometimes even personal computers. Irons says his plan is to get a master's degree in public administration and eventually work in the nonprofit sector. But the clarity Irons has today is a long way from where he started.
I was in prison a very long time, nearly 25 years. I caught somebody stealing from me. I was a drug dealer. Caught someone stealing from me, and I killed him over it. And John didn't deserve to die for that. Looking back on it, I realize that. I realize my responsibility and my arrogance and all of those things. The parole board found me suitable 3 times. Governor Schwarzenegger reversed my grant of parole 2. It was the 3rd time, finally let me out. I knew that coming out of such a structured environment, I would need some kind of a structure for my life. I couldn't just come out with, and at my age and with a record and all of those things, I'm virtually unemployable. I knew I would need some kind of a structure, and school would provide that. And it has. One of the primary reasons I chose City College was because of the Second Chance program there. It's the only one in the state. I called them and made an appointment with one of the peer counselors, a man a little younger than I am, but who'd been incarcerated and kind of had an idea what it was like. And when I came in, he helped me do the registration and stuff. And I probably could have gotten through it on my own, but I was really intimidated by it, and I probably wouldn't have tried. And if I had run into some minor problem, it's entirely possible I would have just given up, not realizing that it was a minor problem, thinking it was just overwhelming. It made the whole thing a lot more comfortable. Just knowing that I was talking to somebody who had been – that I didn't have to choose my words too carefully. I didn't have to be too conscious of how much I revealed about my past, made it a lot easier. And there are a few things that the Second Chance program does officially. Like, there's a psychology class that they run that is specifically for Second Chance students. That class covers, for lack of a better word, I'm going to call it life skills things, from our relationships with our parents and history with drug abuse or sexual abuse or all of those things that go into the makeup of who we are today. So we get to explore those psychological and emotional developmental issues in a way that would freak out the average 18-year-old fresh out of high school student. The Second Chance program officially deals just with school stuff, but they have peer counselors, and it's a community where we can be supportive of each other. There are, I think, about 200 students at City College who are part of the Second Chance program. And for at least for me, and I think for a lot of Second Chance students, there's a part of us that doesn't feel completely human or completely accepted in society, even after relatively long periods of time of, you know, having been back as part of the community. And that can be really important, those relatively minor things, that recognition. Yeah. I was one of the commencement speakers, and I was really proud of that. That felt like an accomplishment. And on a very personal level, one of the things I shared in my commencement address was the fact that I'd been incarcerated a long time. And it was difficult to stand up in front of 3,000 people and admit that. But it felt, it was part of a healing process for me personally. But I think it provided some encouragement for people who are going through their own struggles, even though that's not the details of their struggle. Everybody is going through some struggle in their lives. You know, my graduating class had a great number of, you know, single parents that have struggled with balancing raising kids and trying to keep make ends meet while going to school and get an education. Immigrants who or people who don't speak English as a first language, you know, dealing with the language and cultural issues while trying to get an education. I hope it gave them all some encouragement that whatever the struggle is, it's worthwhile.
That's Carl Irons, a graduate of City College of San Francisco and a participant in the Second Chance program for formerly incarcerated students. That piece was produced by KALW's Jen Chien. Tune in on Wednesday when we'll bring you an in-depth look at the situation at City College, including our talk with Special Trustee Robert Agrella.
When you read the story, it's not quite what the byline says. You know, a portion of the process that we're in is that we must write a closure report. But when people say, well, they're writing a closure report, after all, that must mean that they're going to close. No.
And this week, we want to hear your stories about City College. Are you a student unsure about your situation? Are you a graduate? Give us a call and tell us your story at 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to put your voice on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. City College's student body reflects the amazing diversity we have in the Bay Area. The system serves people from every kind of economic and cultural background. The Bay's diverse makeup is obvious in many aspects of life here, including our food.
If you cook it just right, as soon as you put it in the oil, the outside shell seals, and so it doesn't allow oil to get into it.
That's Ramzi Tatari, owner of Falafel Etc. in the East Bay. It turns out that there are many ways to make falafel, and you can find them right here in the Bay Area. In this story from our archives, KALW's Hana Baba goes on a falafel shop hop to find the best version of her favorite comfort food.
My name is Ramzi Tatari. Originally, I was born in Nazareth, Israel. And my dad had a falafel shop in Nazareth.
Tatari is owner of Falafel Etc. in Fremont. He went to college in this country, worked in the high-tech industry for many years, but he returned to his roots with falafel.
The falafel is part of the tradition in every one of the Middle Eastern countries. Every street corner has a falafel stand on it. They don't have hamburger stands, they have falafel stands.
Totri is an Israeli-Palestinian, and where he comes from, Jews and Palestinians alike make falafel with garbanzo beans, like what I'm used to in Sudan. We're looking at a batch ready for frying.
The yellow color is the garbanzo beans, which is 95% of the mix. We add onions, garlic, parsley, cilantro, cumin.
But just before frying, Chef Ramzi adds a bit of baking soda to fluff up the falafel, he says, to make it lighter. And as my mother always told me, the oil must be hot, just like Chef Ramzi's. So the falafel balls dive like swimmers to the bottom and rise back up again.
If you cook it just right, as soon as you put it in the oil, the outside shell seals, and so it doesn't allow oil to get into it.
He's right. Crunchy on the outside, not oily on the inside. And even though he makes it every day, Chef Ramzi never tires of falafel.
Our order is 6 pieces of falafel. I'll make 7. The 7th one is the taxes, you know. Uncle Ramzi has to have his taxes, so I get a falafel and I just eat it by itself. I love eating it by itself.
Despite being proud of his Palestinian-style falafel, Ramzi Totri admits that falafel didn't originate in Palestine or Israel. Experts say it came from Egypt. So I headed over to an Egyptian sandwich shop in San Francisco. The back kitchen of Pharaoh's Mediterranean Sandwich Shop is stocked with dozens of spices, vegetables, and the smell of cilantro fills the space. Yasmin El-Mursi is preparing a fresh batch of falafel mix.
This is the fava beans that was soaked yesterday.
That's right, fava beans, not garbanzo. This is the Egyptian way, and most don't call it falafel. They call it
tameya. Falafel is like an Arab-Syrian-Palestinian word. It's not pure Egyptian word. It's called tameya.
Fava beans are a staple food in Egypt that go as far back as the pharaohs. And paintings inside their tombs, some believe, depict the act of frying falafel. Another theory is that the dish originated with Egypt's Coptic Christians as a substitute for meat during Lent. And now, thousands of years later and thousands of miles later in San Francisco, Yasmin, her father, and 4 brothers are running a restaurant that offers falafel prepared the same way.
It's a family restaurant and with family recipes. My mother's recipe, she passed away, so she taught me and I taught my father and my brothers how to do the recipes.
Yasmin's mother prepared falafel with some of the same ingredients as Chef Ramzi uses in his Palestinian recipe. Parsley, cilantro, onion, all blended together in the food processor. And after she makes it as smooth as possible, the spices are hand-mixed in. Black pepper, sesame, some salt, and the key ingredient, freshly ground coriander.
It makes the taste of the falafel. So be generous with the coriander.
After frying, the falafel rest, draining their oil. And they seem to call out to me to try my first fava bean falafel.
Here we go. Mmm, coriander.
Yeah.
It's very flavorful, and the salt is just right. Mm. And it's like crispy on the outside, but moist on the inside, not raw,
but
moist.
Yasmin says she gets lots of Middle Eastern people coming in, but her Egyptian customers want to make sure they're getting it their way. There's a pride in knowing it's an Egyptian tamiya.
They are asking us, is it pure Egyptian? Do you do it with fava beans or garbanzo beans? We said, no, it's made of fava beans. It's pure fava beans, don't worry.
So that gets me thinking. If falafel originated in Egypt with fava beans, why are many made with garbanzo, including ours in Sudan, which is actually geographically the closest to Egypt? I needed some answers, so I called up renowned cookbook author and food historian Claudia Roden at the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery in England.
Because they use what they grow, and because they grow chickpeas in Israel and Palestine. So it is the one that they would use. You use what is most available.
Ah, so people made it with whatever bean was most plentiful locally. That makes sense. But then there's another way falafel is made. If you're, say, from Lebanon, you combine the two beans. You go half and half.
Kerbanzo beans and faba beans. That's my Lebanese way.
Madame Leila Sfer moved here from Lebanon with her husband and children over 30 years ago. She runs this small catering business in Fremont. No surprise, falafel is her most popular dish.
Who makes the best falafel?
Me.
Madame Leila is 72 with the energy of a 30-year-old. She uses a large commercial grinder to mix her ingredients together. She stands on a crate because she's not tall enough to put her half-and-half mixture in. And when it's done, it looks almost more vegetable-y than beany.
Yours is very green.
And tasty. I put a lot of green. I put the parsley, cilantro. I like it green.
Madame Leila fries her falafel until, she says, they're a magic golden color. And then she grabs a large paper-thin pita bread wrap, puts three falafels on it.
Some tomatoes, tahini sauce, soak it good, some lettuce.
And the falafel sandwich is complete. And it's not just for her customers. Leila Sfer also enjoys making it for her family and neighbors.
I make it all. Yummy! I like it. And then I make it again and again.
As I taste all the styles of falafel, each tasty in its own way, each flavorful, unique, and worthy of its people's unwavering pride, I realize that maybe it's not who makes the best falafel. As food historian Claudia Roden told me, it's the way you were brought up eating it. That means everything to you. In Fremont, I'm Hannah Baba for Cross Currents. We have the recipes from each of the three falafel chefs you heard from, including Hannah's mother's recipe, online at klw.org. That's also where you can see pictures of the falafels and the chefs, and add more of your own in the comments section. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. The Bay Area is famous for its food, from the sourdough bread to the gourmet food trucks and the Mission's Super Burrito. There's a story behind how these delectables got to be the way they are, and you can find many of them in author Erica J. Peters' new book. It's called San Francisco, A Food Biography. She and KALW's Stephen Short recently got together to chat about some of the better-known items. Let's listen in.
Omnivore Books in San Francisco's Noe Valley neighborhood has just officially closed for the day, yet now the space is filling with people.
I bought a book from the city here last Saturday.
A lot of them have brought things. I see some fortune cookies, and there's some digger bread from the hippie era. There's a man shaking pisco punches, a very traditional San Francisco drink. And there's olive bread, olives from California.
It's all San Francisco related.
It's all San Francisco related. And
if you're trapped in the corner, I'm happy to deliver it.
These 40 or so people and their snacks have come to hear author Erica J. Peters talk about understanding San Francisco through its food.
I'm going to start with Hangtown Fry. Mary Margaret is right there, provided for us.
They're fabulous.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mary Margaret is a food writer and private chef in San Francisco who goes by the name M.M. Pack. Hangtown Fry is an egg-based dish that looks something like a scramble. And judging from people's responses, it's delicious.
I use Tadich Grill's recipe.
That's a local restaurant that's been serving Hangtown Fry since it opened back in 1849.
I think the original recipe was a little simpler, but it's still an incredibly simple recipe. You have some oysters, you have some bacon, you have some eggs, you can have Hangtown Fry.
Hangtown. That's still the nickname of Placerville, California, seat of El Dorado County on Highway 50 in the Sierra foothills. This is where official and unofficial justice was dispensed. And that's how it got that nickname, Hangtown. I asked Peters about the significance of Hangtown Fry when we met in North Beach for cappuccino a few days after her talk.
Why was this considered so special, and why was it so expensive? It's just a fresh oyster omelet.
Because over there at the mines, you couldn't get fresh eggs, or if you could, it was $2 an egg, $3 an egg.
You might find a gold nugget as big as a hen's egg, but you wouldn't find a hen's egg.
Exactly, exactly.
Hangtown was the first place where newly rich miners could really spend their gold, and chicken eggs and fresh oysters were some of the hardest things to find. Back then, $1 had the buying power of more than $25 today, meaning a good Hangtown fry could set you back $75 or more in today's money.
The high cost of living in the Bay Area becomes easier to bear when considering miners paying out their hard-won gold for an overpriced oyster omelet.
That certainly puts today's $8 a dozen organic eggs into perspective. Another basic food that traces its origins to the miners is the famous San Francisco sourdough bread. As Sunset Magazine said last year, it's everywhere, this bread, as much a Golden Gate fixture as Coit Tower or the cable cars. And it was the city's staple bread during the gold rush.
So the story everyone knows about sourdough in San Francisco and the connection is that the miners were off there in the mines, and this was their method of making bread for themselves because they were so far away from civilization. And then they would come back to San Francisco, and people in San Francisco loved the taste of that sour bread that the miners were making, and so then San Franciscans adopted the bread from the miners.
An advisory now to anyone who has ever purchased a loaf of authentic San Francisco sourdough bread. You may want to sit down during the next part of this report.
There is nothing accurate about that story. That just blows my mind, that we have a whole story that we all tell each other and there is no part of it that is true.
What is the truth?
The truth is that the miners who are called sourdoughs are not our miners at all. They're the Klondike miners up in Alaska in the end of the 19th century, the 1890s. Those miners are very far from civilization. No one is bringing them supplies.
North to Alaska, to go north for less is on.
And they do have to carry pots of sourdough starter on their bodies to keep it warm for months until the supply ships come back. And they are called sourdoughs. Jack London writes about them, the famous sourdoughs. But it's not our miners.
They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold.
Peters is careful to note that the ovens of San Francisco's Boudin Bakery have been producing French bread since the Gold Rush era. But as far as anyone can tell, the tangy sour taste didn't really catch on until the early 1900s. At a time when civic boosters were trying to latch onto foods that they could tie directly to the city by the bay.
They were trying to bring tourism back to the city, especially after the earthquake, and trying to promote San Francisco and find iconic foods that San Francisco could become famous for. San Francisco latched on to the sourdough taste as a way to promote itself.
Not all the entries in San Francisco, a food biography, are as shocking as that one, but some come close, such as the description of this prized dish from the mid-1800s. The finest thing that mortal ever put between his teeth is a cow's head baked with the hair on. Its sweetness can only be dimly guessed at by people who have never eaten it. If you think that sounds revolting today, imagine what those miners would say if you tried to serve them curdled soybeans, better known as tofu. Ready for a snack? I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
That's author Erica J. Peters speaking with KALW's Stephen Short. And Erica Peters will talk about her book at the California Historical Society this Wednesday at 6 p.m. It'll be followed by a one-night-only viewing of items from the Society's collection on California food history. All of that information is at kalw.org, which is also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Julie Kane, Jen Cheehan, Audrey Dilling, Seth Samuel, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Gensler-Debs, Liz Mack, Daphne Matsiaraki, Mary Reese, Judy Silber, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was produced by Leela Day and engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And because of your support, we can proudly say that we are listener-supported public radio. You're hearing the Daniel Castro Band. Castro grew up hanging around blues clubs in Southern California, and he's lived in the Bay Area since the mid-1990s. Their drummer describes their sound this way: "We play big." The Daniel Castro Band will be playing at Club Fox in Redwood City on Wednesday starting at 7 p.m. It's part of the club's weekly blues jam. You can find that information along with more local music and more local stories at KALW.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.